Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Have a mix of naughty and nice. Poetry allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of the show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustments to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. Welcome. This is Babbler. Our normal hostess, Ephesiana, has today off. Hope she's having a good time relaxing and recovering. I don't know who I have on the line with me, if anybody. So feel free to speak up.
Well, hello, Babbler. Yes, you have me, Pam. I'm sorry. I didn't realize somebody didn't tell you. Yes, I am here not only to run your phone, but I can, you know, whatever you want me to do, post links, of course, read and comment, you know,
perfect.
All good with me.
Much appreciated. I'm like, I don't mind. So it's a good surprise. How are you
doing? Yeah. Oh, I am doing great. As a late birthday present, my son tomorrow is taking me to St. Paul, Minnesota, where we are going to see Violent Femmes and the Breeders in concert, and then we're going to spend the night at a hotel. So I'm extremely excited about that.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. That sounds like a good time.
Yes.
I'm probably in for a fairly rough weekend. I'm moving, so literally right now, my house is full of boxes. The mover show up at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and the migration begins.
Wow. Well, are you moving to like across the United States or a short move? Or?
It's a short move. I'm actually, my new house is like, I don't know, half mile, a mile from my current house. So not far of a trek, but still getting everything out of a house and moving
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah. Right? It is. That's cool. But it is a lot of work.
I took Monday and Tuesday off so that I hopefully get some relaxed time before I got to go back to work, because this is not going to be a weekend.
It'll definitely be a busy weekend for you, so you'll need those extra couple days off to actually count as being your weekend.
That was my thought. That was why I took them, because I'm like, I'm going to need downtime, because it's not really going to be downtime. Frantically putting my house together.
Yep, exactly.
All right. Well, tonight, the contest theme was Horizon. I wanted to leave it pretty open. I don't know. I'm kind of a big fan of kind of open-ended, loosely themed contests, just because I don't like to impinge on creative freedom. You know, I'm not super great at sticking to really tight contests, and I figure maybe that's the case as well for other people. Maybe they'd appreciate that. Who knows? I could be way off. I was looking for Rights About Horizon, like off in the distance, what do you see just past the edge? This is fairly open-ended and up for interpretation. Move me, make me feel what you're penning, 1,000 pen strokes across my heart. So I put some inspiration up, just in case people were feeling the need for a little push. There's some photos of different horizons and a couple different quotes. I'll give the quotes a quick read. But they were, keep your eyes on the horizon and your nose to the wind, Clint Eastwood. The horizon is an imaginary line that recedes as you approach it, by Jennifer Goodwin. When good things are on the horizon, you keep walking towards the sun. That's anonymous. And the horizon of many people is a circle with a radius of zero. They call this their point of view. That was from Albert Einstein. That's the theme of the night.
Very cool. I like it. Great theme.
Thank you. So I was thinking, Pam, if you don't mind grabbing off the board, then we can go ahead and read and alternate commenting. What do you think?
All right. That sounds like a good plan to me. All right. So I'll go ahead and start with Red Moon in the Sky by Marvin Goldfarb. And it goes like this. Red moon in the sky, hiding behind clouds, it is shy. When will it appear on its own and let its appearance be known? In the meantime, it is a red moon in the sky, hiding behind clouds, it is shy, but I wonder why. End poem.
Great read, Pam. This is an interesting poem. Red moon in the sky, I picture like a blood moon or some kind of eclipse, you know? But then it's hiding behind clouds, so you can't even really see it. It almost makes me wonder if it's actually the sun that's so blocked that you can't really see it. It almost looks more like a moon than the sun. You know, I've certainly seen that before. Or during like a wildfire, you'll get that kind of reddish moon hue, you know? And then when will it appear on its own and let its appearance be known? Like, the idea of it being shy, you know, hesitant to appear. So I find it fascinating. It's like the personification of the moon, and it's hiding rather than waiting to come out. I find it very interesting. I wish I knew just a little more about the red moon, but I think that's part of the allure of the piece, is that it's mysterious and that it has great rhyme and flow to it, with sky and shy and own and known. It kind of gives it a little bit of a almost nursery rhyme, but not quite. I thought this was a great little brevity. Your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, I have to say, you know, I like what you had to say about how the it had a nursery rhyme kind of feel to it, and about how it was left kind of open-ended, like you want to know more about the red moon, and yet there's that kind of appeal to it. There is something, you know, I guess because red moons aren't very common, you know, I get the idea of it like being a metaphor for someone or something that is very rare and very precious. I also think of that saying about, you know, red sky at night, sailor's delight, even though this is just the moon instead of the whole sky. It does bring that thought to mind. And I like how this kind of takes us into that. It has a feel, even though it doesn't say it specifically, between the personification of the moon and the hiding. There's a very, like, mythological type feel to it. And I like how this is, it's very observational. You know, it's so short, so straightforward that even though it's more dreamy-like, it kind of, oh man, who's that poet that writes like really straightforward style, like he does The Red Wheelbarrow and Peaches, Carl something? Is it what?
Sanborn, I think? Something like that.
I can't remember, but it reminds me of this.
It's William Silas Williams is who it is. Sorry.
Yes, that's it. That's the one. It kind of reminds me of his style in its own way. So excellent brevity and very well done.
I like what you said about it feeling mythological, you know, because it kind of goes with that idea of lending a story to something, you know, writing its background. It almost gives the red moon its own little mythology, a little start of one. Excellent comment. What do we have up next?
Up next we have Horizon's Drum by Garanwy. And Babbler, will you read that for us, please?
Absolutely. This is Horizon's Drum. John Lee Hooker was booming, leaving sound behind. The searing wheel was beating to Horizon's Drum. The lake was reflecting the emptiness of sky. In the rhythm of the road found in the engine beat, I stopped by its side, hearing chords ebb and flow, in visions made of mist, skimming stones of memories, made on road trips to nowhere, just by being on the road. Lost and found in diners with brown bag liveners, smoking cigarettes in the landscape of the moon. Found in the destination of no particular place to go, looking for tomorrow, hoping it never comes, on a road trip of forever, if you will hold my hand. You can be Mathied, I will be Jackie, as we sing along with Brel, somewhere on the road to the port of Amsterdam. Let's read beat poetry in the Chelsea of New York, drink beer with Thomas Swansea's Quidamkin Park. In all our journey is forever, pack your bags and let's go. End poem. I really liked the piece. It had its own kind of rhythm to it because almost every line ends in a period, like a nice hard stop. Which gives it an almost kind of drum-like feel as you read it. I also think it does a really great job of capturing, like, that wanderlust that's part of traveling. I love to travel. I've only got to do it a little bit, and I do it more recently, which is great. I didn't have money to do it with when I was younger. but, you know, that calling to just to leave, to go explore, to find all these things. I like to move the nods to things, especially no particular place to go. You know, obviously pulls the song to mind. And then, I mean, that matches as well with the few lines above where it mentions diners, because then it instantly calls like that 50s style mid-century diner with all the chrome and vinyl, at least just for me. You know, I'm hoping that it never ends. And, you know, to personify all of these people. I assume there's some story behind that those names that I don't know particularly well. It definitely feels like a reference, but it's not one I'm familiar with. You know, and then just all the different places to explore. You know, and it feels like a road trip, but it also just feels like a metaphor for living, for a journey, especially with somebody. You know, if you'll hold my hand, we can do it together. And then that last line, in all our journey is forever, pack your bag and let's go. You know, let's live life is what it kind of is saying to me. You know, the adventure is calling. It kind of reminds me a little bit of a thought I've been having recently, where my husband and I are trying to pick out a couch for our new house because our new living room is huge and our old living room is very small. So we need to buy a sofa. And he wants to buy a pretty expensive sofa, and I do not, because I would rather spend it on other things like travel. You know, and in my opinion, all I can think is I have my entire life to buy a fancy sofa, but I may not be able to do the travel that I want to do in a few decades. So anyway, just makes me think of that, you know, adventure calls. I really enjoyed it. I felt it had a very good mood to it. Your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, well, first of all, I like you share that little bit of extra information besides making your astute comment on the poem itself. You know, you're right. With the periods at the end of each line, this does have a rhythm to it. And I think it's supposed to feel like you're reading, like as someone's playing the drums in the background. I did like that he brings up the blues singer guitar player, John Lee Hooker. And you can, because I really feel like one of the most important parts of any road trip is the music chosen to listen to. And, you know, I really did like how this is not like that he took the idea of horizon, you know, metaphorically rather than literally, like the idea that the horizon isn't a specific thing you're heading towards, but rather just, you know, living your dream, getting out there, traveling that wanderlust. Cwmdonkin Park, I've heard that before, but, you know, my guess would be, and I'd have to look it up, Thomas Swansea's Cwmdonkin Park must be a poem, but I don't know for sure. It's something I'll have to look into. You know, and that's what I've said before. I really enjoy and appreciate poetry that, you know, makes me seek to learn more. I like looking for tomorrow, hoping it never comes, because that really, to me, speaks very well on the whole idea of how important it is to live in the moment and appreciate what we have in the moment. So just a wonderful write and very well done.
I agree with you on the concept of I love poems that make me do research, you know, make me go, what's that about? You know, but don't lose the emotion of it. Like, I still got the emotion and the vibe of the poem. I thought that was very well done, even if I didn't understand or know every reference, you know, and then to give a nod to things to make me look them up, to spark my curiosity. I have always enjoyed, I like poems that make me grow. I thought this was a great one. Excellent comment. Excellent comment. Where are we headed to now?
Well, that is a good question. Let me see if I grabbed the next poem because, well, sometimes I do. Well, most of the time I do, but you just never know. So here we go. And all right. Oh, nope, I didn't. Sorry. Let me go ahead and grab the next one. All right. So, here we go. All right. Up next, we have Creations of the Light by Greg Gall. And it goes like this. Human minds use the light, fire thoughts to the mind sky. Fools flail for all their might. Angry screams hide each cry. To view the true soul source take long look at the sun. See earth's lasting first force. Its rays can't be undone. Dark dreams occur at night. While there's no sun up high, atoms fuse, lumens bright, wise ones won't tell us why. Myths are spun by the sages, unsure advice to try. Faith-filled tales through the ages, many truths to deny. We all live with some fright, nature needs to be heard. Hope that we do what's right, light shines the final word. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I found very interesting, you know, the human mind views the light, you know, to just think about light. And there's so many different contexts for light that, like, obviously the idea of human mind musing light is very accurate. You know, it's used to, like, as actual light, but it can also be used as knowledge, an idea, brightness. You know, warm, like there's so much. And then even in that next line, you know, fire thoughts to the mind sky, like fire itself being like a light source, and something that, you know, is mythologically referenced a lot, like, you know, the when humans discovered how to make fire, you know, and the mind sky, you know, it's like the idea that the brain itself is endless. Of course, sky then also makes me think of the sun. So it's very well tied all in together. And then the next stanza, to view the true soul source, take long looks at the sun. You know, obviously don't take long looks at the sun if you want to see anything else, because long looks at the sun without some kind of eye protection is going to burn your retina. You're not designed to take long looks at the sun. But then that also makes me think, you know, maybe we aren't meant to know everything. You know, that can be its own metaphor. You know, because I think most people know you're not supposed to take long looks at the sun. I don't, you know, it's interesting. I feel like that's a piece of advice that, like, every child gets at some point. But no, I don't really know why. Like, there's no, like, handbook that's like, tell your kids don't look at the sun. But I think just, like, everybody knows that. Like, it's just kind of general knowledge. I'm sure I was told at some point, much along the lines of don't sit too close to the TV, but it is kind of an interesting piece of knowledge that I think most people have heard. So when I read it, I am like, you know, no, you're not supposed to do that, you know. And then to say, see Earth's lasting first force, its rays can't be undone, you know, pulls my mind to the idea that, you know, all the energy on Earth comes basically from the sun. There is some heat at the core of the Earth, but that's not most of the Earth's energy. You know, a lot of the energy comes, like, from the sun. So, you know, that it pulls back again to that idea of light. Dark dreams occur at night when there is no light, obviously. Atoms fuse, lumens bright. You know, fusion and the light, you know, caused by that. Wise ones won't tell us why. You know, people not revealing the secrets, like nuclear fusion and fission, probably a good idea. I mean, I don't know about won't tell us why, because, you know, obviously it's a breakdown of energy, it's a release of energy, but I guess it depends on how deep you want to get into that. But I love the carryover from, like, light and how it appeals to, like, knowledge, but also, like, the source of life itself, and how interwoven all of those things are. You know, myths spun by the sages. Again, it's to like the idea of light as an idea. Brightness being like knowledge as well as actual sun as well as energy. I like this. I feel like it's all really well intertwined. And then that last stanza, you know, we all live with some fright. Nature needs to be heard. Hope we do what's right. Light shines is the final word. I feel like that's like a call to environmentalism, you know, in a way, like to take care of what we have. And yet also to fear Mother Nature. You know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, it's going to be the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of the world, but it might be the end of humanity. The world will go on. We may or may not be here to see it, but the world will be fine. you know, it's a bit self-important. and, you know, just the ethics of that. And then, of course, light shines the final word. You know, light from the sun, you know, eventual heat death, but also knowledge and enlightenment, you know, again. So I feel like it's beautifully interwoven with multiple layers of the use of the word light. So I found this a fascinating piece. Very cool. What's your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, I like this. I like how it has a nice tight rhyme scheme. I like how, as you said, there's different uses for the idea of light. It can be taken on a metaphorical level. I particularly liked how you brought up the idea that we all know not to take long looks at the sun. So that in itself works as a metaphor for the idea of things that we're not supposed to have, or we're not supposed to have everything. There was part of me that thinks, especially with the opening, human mind, muse, the light, fire, thought to the mind, sky, is this about, you know, the seeking of knowledge. I really like myths are spun by the sages, unsure advice to try, faith-filled tales through the ages, many truths to deny. You know, the way that stories or advice passed along gets twisted. You know, and then you start to wonder, well, where did this come from? It's like this, and I don't know if you've ever heard this one before, and it's so absolutely silly, but somehow I had heard, and other people I know had heard, that cold water boils faster than hot water. And I never believed it, you know, because it never made sense to me, but it was something you heard. And I remember, like, I was in my 30s and I had this friend over, and she, I was filling a pan up with hot water so I could sit on the stove to start the water boiling. She goes, you know, it'll boil faster if you start with cold water. And I told her, no, it wouldn't. And she said, yes, it would, because that's what I've heard my whole life. And it's like, okay, but does that really make sense to you? I know, because I heard it too, but do you really think that water that starts at 0 degrees is boiling faster than, you know, water that starts at 100 degrees, you know, and obviously, it, you know? But I know that was a little bit of a tangent, but it kind of reminds me of how the things that we hear over and over again, especially in our childhood by people that we assume are almost godlike to us because they're adults, you know, and that idea that, you know, this must be the truth, you know. And so it's really, to me, about seeking that light of knowledge. So just a wonderful, thought-provoking write and very well done.
I love that little side story. I totally get you, mean. You're like there are tons of incorrect wives' tales or, you know, I don't even know what we call them, like, tidbits of wisdom that are just not true. I've heard so many of them. And it's just like, will you apply a little bit of thought to this before you just repeat what you hear? Like, think about it for a second. I mean, I get where, like, the root of that comes from, you know, with the boiling water, because cold water will absorb heat faster until it reaches the same temperature as the hot water. And then they're going to boil. I mean, it's not that different. It'll be slightly slower because it's cold. It needs to absorb more heat. But I mean, it sounded funny, like the different tidbits of wisdom that just don't make any sense if you really think about them. The other one that comes to mind is like that rodents don't have bladders and just pee everywhere that they go. And it's like,
oh, wow. I've never heard that one.
Yeah, I've heard that one from a few people. I've got contacted a lot about it when I was in college because I worked with a lot of rodents. I have a biology degree. And it's like, no. And think about that from the stance of, like, biology. Like, a predator is going to be able to find your den so easy if you're just constantly leaving a trail of urine everywhere you go.
Yeah, right. But can you imagine how much fluid they'd have to drink?
There's a million things wrong with this. Will you please think about it first?
Oh, that's too funny.
Anyway, it just there's so many of them. They're fascinating. So I don't know. I enjoyed that tangent because it's so true. Just what can be considered like wisdom handed through the ages is actually just bullpucky in some cases. So
yeah.
Anyway. Thanks for the little side journey there. Made me think about some things. What are we off to now?
All right. Up next, we have Olivia by David Philip Ireland. And will you give that a read, please?
Absolutely. Olivia by David Philip Ireland. When they had first moved into the house by the mill, Olivia had discovered a colored drawing hidden under a corner of the bathroom linoleum. The drawing was old and faded, the work of a child. In the picture, five ladybirds stood by the door of a toadstool house. Through the open doorway, a chestnut shell rocked. Beneath blue covers, a tiny ladybird slept. Olivia had kept the drawing pressed tight between her marriage certificate and the passport application forms that yellowed in her dressing table drawer. Sometimes she would leaf through the memories and might softly cry, and he would notice, or he would not notice. And now he hardly ever noticed, and Olivia had never shown him the child's drawing. She caught sight of the block of the mill. She could see quite clearly the high Venetian windows, the water wheel, and the tall, tapering chimney. She could see the reservoir and the Cane's Cross Road. Soon her eyes would focus on the house. Color wash was dry. The ribbon of the Severn lay placidly in the valley, sifting silt toward the estuary. Closer sprawled the scars of the city, invisible grids linking life to life. Power cables stretched taut like ley lines, resonating with unfelt tremors. These things Olivia would set down in a meticulous web of color. The limestone outcrop was a mile or two from the house. She ruled here, indomitable among the ammonites and glinting quartz that served as her treasure store. Gerald laughed at the pocketfuls of minerals and bones she emptied onto the kitchen table. She had been here on blustery kite-flying days, on gliding days, ice cream days, Saturdays, and Sundays. It was quite different then, but the weekdays belonged to her. She saw a few others, the peripheral dog walker, the horse on the horizon, the vapor trail of a distant droning plane, but little else to crowd her. This was a really interesting write. The mood is very wistful and almost beachy. You know, it's got this reminiscent feel to it that's almost somber, but there's tenderness. I wouldn't quite say bittersweet because it's not particularly sad. It's more just like a recollection is how it feels. You know, a looking back on how things were, not so much with judgment, but some emotion. With the observation, you know, talking about when you first move to a place and you find a little drawing from a kid who lived there some time before, you know, and the keeping of it, and thinking about all the different places. I found it a little sad that, you know, the person I assumed to be her husband, you know, noticed that she cried and then slowly stopped noticing. But the crying didn't really stop, and yet never showed him the child's drawing, which I found fascinating. I wondered, you know, if maybe, like, she couldn't have children or if maybe they'd lost children, you know, why the sobbing from the child's drawing. And then a good look at the landscape around and the different places that mean things to her, to the point where she would paint them, you know, paint all of the landscapes and places that kind of make up her life, or the history of this place that they live, and the different experiences that she had with them. You know, like, obviously she sees this limestone outcrop that's almost a fortress, you know, the way it's described, you know, is ruling here, indomitable, you know, among these stones. And yet, then again, I think this is her husband that's kind of mocking her, you know, that's almost making out the stories that she writes for her life as silly and childish, you know, and maybe that painting from the child kind of is representative of her, like, not willing to really give up that childlike quality of herself, you know, despite getting older. You know, even to think of weekends as ice cream days is wonderfully childish. You know, ice cream isn't limited to children, but I don't know too many adults that are like, oh, yay, it's ice cream day. You know, it's, you know, it gets weirdly associated with children. There's something youthful about it, you know. When the ice cream truck comes rolling down the street, it's not usually the adults that come barreling out to get the cone. You know, so I found that fascinating. You know, and then, but the weekdays belonged to her. So it's like the weekends belong to the landscape. They belong to the places around her. And then during the weekdays, she's just in a house. You know, I found that really interesting. And yet it sounds like she feels uncrowded in the house and she feels crowded in the landscape. It's really interesting. I think it's a fascinating look into, like, the mindset of this woman named Olivia, who sounds like she lived a pretty complex and sentimental kind of life. A paragraph or two from a novel called Bloodstones. There's a link to YouTube, which I'm not sure if that's, like, the whole thing or just this excerpt, but I really enjoyed a sentimental description of this piece, and I think it's a good draw for a novel. So, wonderful, right, from David Philip Ireland. Your thoughts, Pam?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's a wonderful excerpt from his novel. You know, he seems to create memorable characters. And I like how he makes the land part of the character too. Like, you can just imagine her looking out across this land and painting it. And, like the line, she could see the reservoir and the King Cross Road. Soon her eyes would focus on the house. Her watercolor wash was dry. The ribbon of the Severn lay placidly in the valley. You could just see that river flowing like a ribbon. I too, my heart was really touched by the lines, and it brought a sadness to me, the idea of someone who was weeping for something that obviously they were grieving about, or something that bothered them. And then, as you said, her husband noticed less and less, and it wasn't like it had stopped. He had just become, I don't know, like, numb to it or, you know, unfeeling to it. There was a certain, it's almost as like this, the idea of someone who, as you said, they're connected to their own childhood, and perhaps because they didn't have children of their own or couldn't have children of their own, they wanted to hold on to some semblance of childhood, even if it was their own. And I really liked at the end where he says, it was quite different then, but the weekdays belonged to her. She saw a few things, the peripheral dog walker, the horse on the horizon, the vapor trail of a distant droning plane, but little else to crowd her. You really get this sense of loneliness within this rite. It's beautifully done.
I like to use the word loneliness there on that end bit, you know, because I thought I was thinking loneliness as well, and yet he used the word crowd. And when I think of being crowded, I think of that as a negative thing, like wanting space but also lamenting the space, you know. So I found that a really fascinating word choice. Excellent observations, Pam. Yeah, I agree. I wish I knew a little more about the grief, but I guess that's what draws you to the novel, right?
Absolutely.
Where are we going now?
All right. Up next, we have Three Levels of Twilight by Diane Dee. And it goes like this. Oh, to walk those weathered wooden planks lined with gunmetal rusty brackets towards the inspirational fire of the sky. The sky's lower belly with fluffy billows of clouds framing floating archway looking like a protractor in the 80s math kit. A glowing setting sun dipped along the horizon. Fleeting colors of dusk fade away, streaming orange-yellow rays upward. Copper-colored hallway lead to a fiery epicenter that separates the west from the east as the three levels of twilight burst open into the hot, intense light faded into the black skyscape. Stand the city skyscrapers strong, black soldiers standing in an unmoving row, an unimaginable mirage, a single flaming moment in time, blazing sparks of scintillating oasis, a single miracle moment in a thousand years. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I really enjoyed the descriptiveness of this piece. There is a photo that's attached to this piece. Of a sunset that is very well described in the piece, but I don't think you really even need it because it's so well described. I think it's almost more fun to envision it yourself, you know, to walk the weathered wooden planks lined with gunmetal rusty brackets toward that inspirational fire of the sky, you know, to walk along this old rusty dock to watch the sunset. Which is something I really enjoy doing. You know, I live right on the coast. I have for most of my life. And I used to live right next to a dock called Taylor Street Dock, which goes right up to Bellingham Bay and is a phenomenal spot for taking photos from there. You know, and then the sky's lower belly. I love the idea of it being a lower belly because especially at sunset, it feels so heavy, like it has gravity to it, that bit of sky just above the horizon line, with fluffy billows of clouds framing floating archways looking like a protractor in an 80s math kit. I mean, I know exactly the kind of protractor that's being described. It's, you know, that clear plastic semicircle with the one arm that you swing around, you know? I think just about everybody had one, right? I mean,
definitely.
I mean, they were fun to play with, but also, you know, teachers a lot would be like, well, you need to learn this because you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket, which I laugh now because everyone has a calculator in their pocket. But... Live, it was live. I think it works well as an image because I think most people have had one of those protractors. At least of a certain age. I don't know about now. Maybe young kids don't get them because you do have a calculator in your pocket. But A glowing setting sun dip below the horizon. Fleeting colors of dusk fade away, streaming orange-yellow rays upward. I mean, again, just the visuals, you know, it's glowing as it dips below, and you can just see the streaming colors above. And then more descriptions of exactly what this looks like, you know, copper and a fiery epicenter, and the levels of twilight burst open. You know, it seems almost like a firework happening just behind the horizon line. Wonderfully descriptive. And, you know, to then throw it against city skyscrapers is fascinating to me as well, because I'm not sure where this dock is, but it must be a lake, where on the other side of the lake you see the city. And I imagine that would be an incredible sight. I haven't seen too many sunsets where I'm looking at the city. I live on the West Coast, so not familiar for me. But I can imagine it, and it's beautifully descriptive. And then I love that, the last line, you know, a single miracle moment in 1,000 years. Every once in a while in my life, I just kind of stop when something happens, something small, something tiny, something coincidental, and I get to see it. And then I think, you know, what were the odds of me seeing it? You know, this moment, this right here, this right now that I got to witness, like the odds of that were so slim and so small, and yet here I am. And I love those kind of almost epiphany-like moments of wonder that I still have in my life. And it feels like one of those kind of moments where you just sit there and go, wow, and I got to see this. Like, this sunset was incredible, and I got to watch it. I really enjoyed the last line. I think it captures well the awe of the observation in the previous stanzas without being like, and it was incredible. You know, it doesn't like wreck the magic of it by stating it too bluntly. So I thought this was wonderfully done. Thank you, Diane B. Pam, your thoughts?
Absolutely. This is beautiful. The poem is captivating. And like you said, I mean, the picture isn't needed because the poem paints the picture. And yet I enjoy looking at the picture as well as looking at the poem. You know, I think in my life, two of the prettiest sunsets I've ever seen were, one was over the Pacific Ocean when I was in California, and the other one was a sunset at the Grand Canyon. But the imagery in this is wonderful. And I had to smile and laugh and nod my head in knowing it's the whole idea of the metaphor of, or the simile of framing floating archways looking like a protractor in an 80s math kit. Very relatable. I love her use of color in this. I really particularly like the line, copper-colored hallway leads to a fiery epicenter that separates the west from the east as the three levels of twilight burst open. I like how she mentions like the idea of the three levels of twilight, almost like the idea of beginning, the middle, and the end, and how it's like this process that you just watch. And like you said, it's one of those moments of just feeling in awe and feeling thankful for something that you get to see. Another line that stood out to me was the sky's lower belly with fluffy pillows of clouds framing floating archways. You know, like the idea of calling the lower part of the sky's lower belly, I had never thought of that, but it works so well because you can almost imagine how, you know, oftentimes the lower belly, even in people who are, you know, you have to be in exceptional good shape not to have at least a little bit of a pooch in the lower belly. And so you can see that kind of curve, that softness within of the description of the sky within that line, that imagery. So, yeah, I thought this was a wonderful write all the way through and very well done.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, and yeah, I do like the idea of the sky being a little plump, not the fittest. I don't know, there's something nice about a little bit of pudge, even for the sun, the sky.
Exactly.
a sinking belly button, maybe.
Oh, there you go. I like that.
Where are we off to now, Pam?
All right. Up next, we have Suddenly Noon by Scraps and Scribbles. And Babbler, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
All righty. Suddenly Noon by Scraps and Scribbles. I watch the water burning. Isles of flame are dancing as they rage out in the smoke. It's quiet now, the violence nearly tame. Just fire on water laughing as it chokes. A mile or so from the shore in frozen fog, a silent tanker changed itself to light. Erupted like the methane in the bogs and scattered shards of shattered sun on night. And even here, it blew me off my feet. The death of metal howled as if surprised. It groaned and wailed, a mournful sound, and heat. It burned my face and paralyzed my eyes. One instant then was night, the seed of noon, such ugliness and beauty born as twins. But fury will exhaust itself, and soon the sad and dying lights began to thin. And soon the sea will swallow up the fire. No requiem can burn eternal pyres. End of poem. Ah, I love this piece. The title is great. Suddenly Noon. You know, you're not really sure what that means when you first read it. It feels like it could be, you know, like losing track of time almost. Then as you read the poem, it's like, no, it's an explosion of fire. I watch the water burning, Isle of Flames. You know, the water's not supposed to burn, you know. They're dancing as they rage. There's like this anger to the piece and yet this beauty of the language at the same time. You know, Isles of Flame dancing as they rage, violence nearly tame. Water laughing as it chokes. Like that's, you know, laughter is such a beautiful thing, but choking not so much, you know, like suddenly you picture like water like strangling the fire, you know, and it's interesting how it goes so back and forth. And you're still not totally sure why the water's on fire until you get closer to the center of the piece, where it says, a silent tanker changed itself to light, erupted like the methane in the bogs, like an oil tanker on the ocean blowing up and lighting on fire, which is like a horrible event. And then you know, the death of metal, which I really enjoyed also because my mind went to like death metal, the music, you know, which also fits here with like that raging anger, you know, and yet music at the same time, you know, howled as if surprised. You can almost hear like the warping of a metal vessel and what that would sound like. You know, he groaned and wailed, just like, you know, like you can kind of hear it in your head. I don't want to try to make that noise again. I'm not sure why I do but, you know, a mournful sound and heat, you know. One instant then was night, the seed of noon, you know, so bright that it felt like midday. Such ugliness and beauty born as twins, you know, to watch the raging fire and again be caught in the awe of the show, the spectacle, and yet the ugliness of what is occurring at the same time, knowing that this is not good, like this is really, really bad. You know, the sad dying lights began to thin. I do love the last couplet, you know, no requiem can burn eternal pyres. You know, no fire can burn forever. And at first it feels like maybe that's a reference directly to these fires that are being swallowed up by the sea and will be extinguished. But then it also makes me think of life itself, you know, no one can live forever. Humanity won't be around forever. Nothing is really forever. So I kind of love philosophy tucked so easily into the last line. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was beautifully done. So thank you, Scraps and Scribbles. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought that, first of all, wonderful comment. Now, I will admit, I immediately, as soon as you started making your whale groaning sound, I immediately thought of, what is that movie, Finding Nemo, where Dory is, trying to talk to the whale, and I had to bite my lip.
That's silly.
Oh, that was fun, though. That was. But no, I like, you're right. There is a philosophy in the last two lines. This is beautifully written. I believe it comes across kind of as a sonnet. I'm not 100% sure if it is, but I think it's very close to a sonnet form, if not exactly. And the idea that, when I first had read this about 3 months back, because it was put into one of Rex's contests, and even the title alone, when it said suddenly noon, I had thought of this flash, and then my first thought actually had been that it had to do with what is that bomb that was in Hiroshima, Japan, is it a
nuclear bomb?
You know what I'm talking about?
Remember.
A nuclear bomb, yes. Like immediately the title made me think of a nuclear bomb, but then as they said, it gives you that a better look at the picture when it mentions the death of metal howled as if surprised, it groaned and wailed a mournful sound and heat, it burned my face and paralyzed my eyes. You can imagine being on the shoreline and watching the ship burst into flame. And the thing with fire, at least in my opinion, is it's so beautiful and so destructive. And what I think this poem really did is it did a wonderful job of capturing how beauty and ugliness can occupy the same space, because you can look at fire and the destruction and know the destruction it causes or has the potential to cause, but also see the beauty in the way the flames dance and glow. So just a really wonderful write and very well done.
I'm glad you mentioned how it talks about how beauty and ugliness, destruction can live together, not just live together, but born as twins. They're kind of a little bit interchanged because it reminds me of a contest that I wrote a while ago when it was flooding really badly here. And I was watching kind of everyone's homes in my area get washed away. It was very similarly the same feeling. I'm watching all this water, all these places that have turned into lakes. And the lakes are beautiful. They're gorgeous, and there's birds on them, and they look lovely. And yet, because they're there, tons of people have lost their homes. It's a horrible disaster. And watching it happen, it just totally captivated by, the beauty of it, but also the sinking feeling of knowing what that means for so many people. A very similar kind of feeling, I think. And I think that pairs up nicely. So I was glad you said that, because it brought me back to that feeling that I've experienced. A wonderful comment.
Thank
what
you.
What have we got going on now? Oh, sorry.
Up next, we have The Great Unknown by Randy G. Lost in their thoughts in the vastness of the sea, viewing the horizon for as far as the eye can see, sailors' lives are full of romantic nautical themes, driving them to the sea in search of their dreams. Some are fishermen, others sail just for pleasure, with iron resolve seeking their individual treasures, hearing the call biting them to the ocean waves for adventures or an invitation to a watery grave. This produces the adrenaline needed for sailing, getting back to the days of old-fashioned whaling, leaving port, casting off into the great unknown, never being sure if you will ever again see home. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I enjoyed the way that this gets at, again, that like call to adventure. You know, the what is it about the ocean that's alluring? What is it about that horizon line that makes you want to see how far away it is? You know, because it looks so far, but it also looks so close. You know, so how far is it really? You know, just, again, that wanderlust. But unlike before where it was more like road trips on the horizon, this is, you know, literally the sea, like that nautical romance, just, you know, wanting to explore it, to feel it. And I love how that's both like a call to general adventure, but also for the act of sailing itself, you know, the actual sea exploration. You know, that middle stanza, some are fishermen, others sail just for pleasure, with iron resolve seeking their individual treasure, hearing the call bidding them to the ocean waves for adventure or an invitation to a watery grave. You know, it's dangerous. There's danger involved. You know, it's not, you know, more danger than, you know, your community swimming pool, for sure. It is great and it is vast. And I feel like that is also the allure. And I think it's that same kind of allure that draws people to space, too. You know, what's out there further than the eye can see? You know, the adrenaline needed for sailing. You know, all the different things that have pushed us out to the ocean and beyond. So I think this gets well at that and explores that idea, you know, the calling of the great unknown. Can we know the unknown? No, you can't, because then it becomes the known. And, yeah. I like the piece. So great writing from Randy G. Your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, wonderful rhyming poem. I like that there's that subtle alliteration, a lot of like S sounds that work really well for a poem about the sea, because it has a kind of a fluid motion to the poem itself. I really felt this was, for a brevity, it was epic. And it was also romantic, like it takes us back to the romanticism of, you know, a time when adventure was to be found on the sea. And I like how that he reminds us, as you mentioned, the idea that some are fishermen, others sail just for pleasure, with iron resolve seeking their individual treasure. And I like the phrase individual treasure because, you know, it's all about what the person seeks to get out of, you know, what fulfills them. And I like that he takes us back in time to when whaling and, you know, even not whaling and also just trade, because, you know, when that's how the majority of trading was done, was by ship. And these young men or these family men who would go out to earn money or to even just earn the prestige of saying, I've been on this adventure, and yet not knowing if it would be their last trip or not. So really just a very classic feel to it. And I very much enjoyed this. It was well done.
Right, it does have a very classic feel. I liked what you said about it being epic, because it does. It feels like an abbreviated epic, you know, the grand adventure in three small stanzas. A wonderful problem, Kim. What are we up to now?
All right, up now we have Horizon by Arliss D. And Babbler, will you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. Horizon. On the flat edge of the horizon, a purple-pink glow beckons me on, across empty fields dusted with snow. Trees raise their hands in praise for the end of this day, plump with possibilities. I have accomplished nothing, yet I turn the lathe one last time, cutting metal, cutting bone, with a wound too deep to be plumbed, too dark to lighten, transfused with blood that stains the sun. Sorrow trails me like a bird dog, sniffing out her prey, startling quail to take flight. I watch them pass overhead. I am not a hunter. They are safe to flee. Coveys, comfort. The world is too much with us, Wordsworth proclaimed. I contemplate his lament, but see no way out. Ancient faces watch my route. I am aimless, famished, still seeking out transcendence, still hungry for God. I embrace the horizon as it bends. Purple-pink sky leads me on. End poem. Well, this is a really fascinating write. You know, at first it seems like someone who is headed out on a grand adventure into this beautiful purple-pink glowing horizon across empty fields dusted with snow. You know, you see this winterscape with this beautiful sun lingering on the horizon. Whether it's going up or down, it's, you know, not really defined. And then it says, I have accomplished nothing. You know, I picture like, oh, is it like a lazy day, you know? But then quickly, no. You know, yet I turn the lathe one last time, cutting metal, cutting bone, with a wound too deep to plumb, too dark and to lighten, transfused with blood that stains the sun, deeply wounded, you know, cutting to the core. Sounds like almost bleeding out, you know, dying. It sounds to me like this next adventure is death. You know, and it's a little sad that it seems like the feeling of life is to have accomplished nothing. You know, that's kind of my take on it. You know, sorrow trails me like a bird dog, be kind of followed by regret and sadness, and comforted by things that escape. I find fascinating. You know, the world is too much with us. As a quote from Wordsworth, you know, so like the world would be better without us is kind of the implication there, which I wonder too if that is comforting. But then it says, but I see no way out. You know, the world has to be with us, which I find very fascinating. And yet still kind of following this path out, you know, still seeking God, still seeking transcendence. I embrace the horizon as it bends. Purple pink sky leads me on. You know, it's kind of this slog towards death, you know, to this next grand adventure. But it doesn't feel particularly, it doesn't feel horribly depressing. It feels like it's almost like a looking forward to death in a way. You know, but not a life without regret, but also not, you know, some terrible life either. It's really contemplative feeling, and some beautiful descriptions of the view, and the word choices. I really liked, you know, turning the lathe, you know, thinking of it as woodworking, you know, just another day being like another turn on the lathe, I thought was a really beautiful metaphor. Overall, I find this piece, you know, like listless. It feels listless to me. But I enjoyed it very much. So thank you, our list. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is beautiful. There's a solemn feel to this. But like you said, it doesn't feel like, you know, like depressing. It feels like this embracing, this acceptance of the end of life and the beginning of something new. I really liked the metaphor of sorrow trails me like a bird dog, because those dogs that are trained to, like, you know, hunt and, you know, or, you know, to find a specific animal, you know, you could just, and they're just relentless in their pursuit. And you could feel that relentless pursuit within those lines. I really like how he brings the quote from the poet Wordsworth in there, and the contemplation. I contemplate his lament, but see no way out. Ancient faces watch my route. I am aimless, famished, still seeking out transcendence, still hungry for God. I like how there's this real strong sense of this seeking of a spiritual, of, you know, something more than what life has had to offer. And I also really like trees raise their hands in praise for the end of this day, plump with possibilities. I love the phrase plump with possibilities and how it gives thought to a sense of hope. So this is an absolutely beautiful rite and very well done.
Yeah, I think you're right about like plump with hope. There is that hopefulness. And I think that's those words are what keeps it from feeling sad or depressed. Ability, still seeking out transcendence. It doesn't feel like giving up. It almost feels like persevering to the next thing. So I'm glad you pointed out that word. I think that word kind of is a trigger for what makes this feel not so downtrodden. So excellent observation, Pam. What do we have coming now?
All right. Up next we have, and up next we have Biologic by E.J. Cool. And it goes like this. Malachite cities rise upon the skeletal firework of conifers, flickering visages born of faint ghosts, their primitive predecessors. Dew-laden air permeates vespertine of the gridity purified of poison. Roaming descendants, thoughtful transcribed notes of crickets oscillate in unison. Neon fireflies pulse whence radioactive street lamps. Inertial tones hummed. In place of fifth cake bus stop, birch harps and rosewood guitars are softly strummed. The galaxy above is evident. Billion of stars reflect long-lost epics, ancient records free from the as seen on TV products, laser beamed aesthetics. Souls sleep not with malice, but dreams of running through primal dawn's woodland. Behind brown elk, U-bows drawn, feathered arrows set to shoot by hunter's hand. The full moon is still and at peace, held high by the verse of great pines, the verve of great pines on mountaintops. For plastic time, eventide wanes, and the mystic chorus of frogs and insects stops. Carnelian shoals break upon the night, exiles majestic morning tides, effulgence wakens sleepy eyes. The soggy mire and pebbled riverside, benevolence once juxtaposes, vulgar sirens blares, and endless congestive toils. Now abandoned ruins bathed by the same forgiving sun, sprout life from fertile soil. End poem.
Ah, wonderful read, Pam. And I really liked this rite. One, it has a stunning flex of vocabulary in here, but also the imagery that's described. The replacing of humanity, city, and all of the things that man built with more natural allegories, like the stand-in, like the equivalent, but what that would look like in nature. Instead of big city buildings, we have malachite cities, these giant stone frameworks, skeletal fretwork of conifers, the bone-like structure of the trees, kind of taking over where cities used to be, roaming descendants, thoughtful transcribed notes of crickets, oscillant in unison, after cities are gone, after society has disappeared, what comes next? And obviously the author, or at least in this piece, paints that very beautifully and very towards the positive. You know, instead of radioactive street lamps, we have neon fireflies. Instead of silk-caked bus stops, we have birch harps and rosewood guitars being strummed by the wind. You know, the galaxy above is evident, not like bleached out by streetlights or as seen on TV, laser-beamed anesthetics. You know, and it's so true. I grew up way out in the woods, you know, with no real city around for a long time. And I could see, I don't know how many stars at night, and I could see the Milky Way at night. It's been years since I've really seen that. Sometimes I miss it, just the amount of stars that I used to be able to see. You know, and light pollution definitely kills that. You know, souls sleep not with malignance, but dreams of running through Primal Dawn's woodlands. I would say my soul, I don't feel like sleeps with malignance necessarily, but I suppose if you frown upon, you know, modern society, it could be phrased that way. And yet, I don't think like this is painted as all of humanity has died, because there's still a bow drawn. There's still hunters present. But it's a much more natural landscape, much more feels like in tune with nature here. You know, the in the Placid time, you have frogs and insects and, you know, those kind of noises. And everything is very beautifully described. You know, now abandoned ruins bathed by the same forgiving sun sprout life from fertile soil. It makes me think of what I mentioned earlier, you know, people talk about the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. It won't be the end of the world, but it may be the end of humanity. Even this doesn't quite end humanity, but it's the end of what we know of civilization. I see, too, in the footnote, the note that there's a quote here that says, adapt or perish, now as ever, is nature's inexorable imperative. You know, so learn to go with it or die. at least in this post-apocalyptic worldview, you know, some people learn to adapt. So, wonderful, right? I enjoyed it very much. Beautifully descriptive, wonderful vocabulary. I enjoyed it very much. Your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, I always enjoy EJ's poetry. She's got a very intelligent use of language and imagery. I too like the opening lines of Malachite Sage, rise above the skeletal fireworks of conifers, flickering visages born of faint ghosts. Like, you can really feel throughout this whole poem, as you were mentioning, that idea of a land in a time of change, of great destruction and great change, and how the ghosts of the past haunt us. I got a kick out of the ancient records free from as seen on TV products, laser beaming anesthetics. Like the idea of these seen on TV products being a source of destruction is, you know, for some reason in my mind, like slightly amusing. I really like that she brings the animals in and the line, the full moon is still and at peace, held high by the verve of great pines on mountaintops. And it makes me think about the idea that, you know, the moon, like as the earth is being changed, as humanity is being destroyed, as the earth is being in part destroyed but not fully, and is going through this whole process of change, The moon remains there looking over everything that is going on. So just really an amazing write and very well done.
Agreed. Just the descriptions are incredible. I think that line about the as seen on TV really just drives home particularly well the fact that this is kind of a post-apocalyptic or post-civilization rite. It almost feels like, oh gosh, why can't I think of the name of the, my brain today. I've been forgetting words left and right. Just crazy, like grasping at vocabulary that's just out of reach today. Oh gosh, it reminds me a bit of Avatar. You know, just the beauty of the descriptions, and yet knowing it's also very earthly. Like, there's nothing fantastical about what she describes. It's all very doable, which matches well the title of Biologic. So, wonderfully done. Great comments, Pam. What do we have up now?
We have Eyes Wide Open by Agent Zero. And Babbler, go ahead and give that a read, please.
All righty. Eyes Wide Open by Agent Zero. My eyes opened, sitting on a beach chair, feet bare, twinkling in the sand. Sunglasses covering my eyes as I'm surrounded by people watching them bathe in sun, tossing a pigskin, drinking a beer with music. Days ago, feeling like I was living in captivity, being judged a mutant. Like bodies strewn over suburban floors, blood drippings from ceilings, like I was a cringe entertainer. Not today, though. Not in the future. Nothing but sand, cold beer, stinky weed, and a good time. End poem. They chose one of the prompts that I had given. The when good things are on the horizon, you keep walking towards the sun. And I think this actually embodies that really well, you know, kind of coming out of depression and stepping into, you know, happiness, something better. It feels like here, particularly summer, you know, realizing as you're sitting on a beach in a chair with beer and some weed, just having a good time, that life has improved. You know, that this is a good time and this is what life is about. And that just days ago, you know, being stuck in the house, feeling judged, feeling crappy, feels so far away all of a sudden, because today feels so good that maybe tomorrow will feel even better. You know, just that looking forward, the positivity of it, you can almost feel the sitting on the beach. Not so much for the stinky weed for me, but I'll take cold beer. Enjoyed the write. I feel like it did well with the quote. It was a beautiful tangential piece. So thank you, Agent Zero, for the write. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like this. I like how it's about living in the moment, but it also does have that, as you mentioned, that feeling of depression and coming out of it. Days ago, feeling like I was living in captivity, being judged a mutant. Being judged a mutant really grabs my attention because of the fact that you have to wonder, were there actually people judging this person? Or is it simply like how sometimes when you go into a state of like almost like paranoia with your depression, that you feel like everybody's judging you, that nobody truly understands what you're going through? Also, really strong visceral imagery in like bodies strewn over suburban floors, blood dripping from ceilings, like I was a cringe entertainer. I'm not 100% sure the phrase cringe entertainer, but what it brings to my mind, and I'll probably have to look it up to learn for sure, but it brings to mind the freak show that used to be very popular in like the 1800s or so. Traveling from town to town, and you pay to go into the tent, and you know, you can just imagine this person, how you know they probably like have the same kind of depression that hundreds of other people have, and yet in that moment, as they're suffering through it, as they're suffering through it, depression or anxiety, that they feel like they're a freak show put on display. And it's kind of nice how, like, I have to agree, I'm not even a beach person, to be honest. I don't really like the feel of sand, but that he brings us down to that everyday language, that what the person in the poem finds relaxing. To go from, you know, feeling like a complete freak show to feeling like you're in your perfect element of sand, cold beer, stinky weed, and a good time is such a sharp turn that it just, it grabs your attention and leaves you thinking about what it must be like to emotionally go through those kind of sharp turns. So beautifully written and very well done.
Oh, I love that you say that you're not a beach person either, because I'm really not. And it's funny because, you know, I've always lived on the coast, like I said before, but man, I much prefer the rocky beaches. I don't like sand at all. I don't like it in my shoes. I don't like it in my armpits. I don't like it in my hair. I'd really just rather not.
Yeah, exactly. Same here.
But I will go sit on a rocky beach and have a good time. And I'm reading now those mental stanzas, you know, days ago, feeling like I was living in captivity, being judged and mutant. Just, it is such a stark contrast, right? Cringe entertainer. I guess what I pictured when I read cringe entertainer is someone who's putting on a show, you know, trying to be liked, you know, like, haha, I'm making jokes, I'm doing a little dance, like me, and everyone's just kind of grimacing at you, like, haha, you know, like it's just not landing, is how I took it, you know, like still feeling other despite desperately trying to, you know, make goodwill, like reaching out repeatedly and just not finding any purchase there. As someone who has bipolar, I understand these turns very much, and I practice really hard to tell myself when I'm feeling crappy and having a really bad day that it's just a bad day. It's not a bad life. It's just a bad day. And I've had really, really good days, and I've had really, really bad days, and it's okay that today is a bad day because tomorrow is a totally different day, and my feelings can really turn on a dime like this. I can go from feeling like a worm to like king of the world. By the way, King of the World isn't so good either, because I feel like I can do anything. I feel like I can take on anything. And that's not true, by the way. Still human. But I relate very much to the drastic change in feeling here. So I'm glad you pointed that out. Excellent comments. What are we up to now?
Yeah. Well, I see here that cringe comedy, and it is a specific genre of comedy that derives humor from social awkwardness, idiosyncratic humor, and guilty pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's the same thing, but, you know, I was doing some Googling and noticed that. So, all right. And up next we have Where the Mystic Rainbow Ends by Kenny W., and it goes like this. Where earth and sky appear to meet, there we should all agree to greet and catch the rising sun. We would enter timelessness itself, worldly troubles left on the shelf, black hole here on earth. Like entering a whole new dimension, free from nautical apprehensions, sailing into the mystic. Later into blackened space and starry sky, soul and spirit soaring, gaining wings to fly, not knowing if we're dead or alive. Where earth and sky appear to meet, galaxies collide all around your feet, broadening your horizons infinitely. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I like the flow of this. It feels like it has... I'm terrible with meter. I'm just going to fess up. Like, I get what meter is. I know what it is. But I am horrible at picking it out in a poem. Like, I don't know if it has an exact meter, but it has a very distinct rhythm. You know, where earth and sky appear to meet, where we should all agree to greet. You know, like, it feels very metered out. And it gives it a really nice rhythm to it, in addition to the rhyme scheme. And then, you know, looking at exactly where rainbows do end, which, you know, would be on a horizon, you know, where the horizon is and all the different things that kind of embodies and encapsulates, you know. It is where you catch the rising sun, you know. It is kind of a place of timelessness because you know, it's day and yet it's not day. It kind of marks beginnings and ends, doesn't it? So it kind of gets into the metaphors of what a horizon is, a black hole here on Earth. So not too much about that one. I mean, a black hole here on Earth would be really, really, really bad. but I think it, you know, again, gets at to that kind of straddling present and future or past and future, you know, the here and now and the what will be and what was. It works as a metaphor for those things. Like entering a whole new dimension free from nautical apprehensions, sailing into the mystic, like getting over that fear of being on the ocean, getting over seasickness, you know, entering into fearlessness. I feel like it almost goes out from horizon in this piece and straight into space, you know, all of the different things. I imagine watching a sunset and contemplating all of the things that lay straight out past the horizon. Like if you were to continue on the ocean and say the world's not round and you're not going to follow the curve of the Earth, and instead you go straight out into space, you know, all of the different things that you could see. So I really enjoyed it. I feel like it's almost like a thought exercise on, like, what would happen if, which I found really enjoyable. So, lovely write from Kenny W. Your thoughts, Ian?
Yeah, I really enjoy and appreciate Kenny's writing. And you're right. I mean, I'm horrible with recognizing meter, but this does have a kind of a rhythm, a beat to it, a consistency in the pattern of the poem that works really well. I really liked the lines, like entering a whole new dimension free from nautical apprehension, sailing into the mystic. It's like almost like an adventure of the mind. Like we've conquered this part of the mind, this part of thinking. So let's move forward. And I like that, the idea of moving forward, of broadening your horizons. And I like how this can be taken as broadening your horizons physically, going to new places, but also mentally broadening your horizons. And finding out what else is out there. I have to say, I think it's really cool that we ran into a couple poems. All the writes in this contest are great, and there's been quite a few pre-writes that have fit very well with your topic of the show, but it's been great to see that you had at least a couple of new writes inspired by the topic. So, you know, very cool and excellent write here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm enjoying the new writes too. I like to see what people, I like a mix of both because I like to see what people have thought about the idea of horizon, but I also like to see what people come up with when prompted on the spot with the idea of horizon. So it's cool to have both at the same time, you know? Agreed. Excellent write from Kenny W. Thank you. What are we up now, Pam?
And up next we have Star in My Hand by Jesna Sajan. And Babbler, will you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. It's the Star in My Hand, Jesna Sajan. I walked in the air, red bright, fire bright scene, white stars twinkling, standing upright, beam. I heard a loud scream. The bang, bright, burst, shook the horizon. I stood upright, first. I looked in a trance, a star flew to me, knew me. I held it in my hands, gentle, seen, too. I look at the stars, none looked at me, flew. So I held this star tight, brimming colorfully. Hours went by, both of us, alive. End poem. Moments of this, you know, star in my hand, you know, to be walking through, walk in the air, you know, imagine it's like being outside and watching the stars, and then it sounds like there's some kind of explosion, you know, a loud scream, the bang, bright burst, shook the horizon, And then I stood upright. You know, I wonder almost if it's like a death, like was there a car accident? Like, this is kind of like the aftermath, or is it like watching a really crazy shooting star in the sky, or maybe a meteor? You know, I find it very fascinating exactly what's happening in this first stanza. Now, I looked in a trance. A star flew to me, newbie. I find that the short, can't think of the word again, but the tidbits between the commas, you know, with all these pauses and these kind of off rhymes, again, give it kind of this interesting rhythm, you know. I looked in a trance. A star flew to me, newbie. I held it in my hands, gentle, seen, too. Like, it kind of punctuates the piece. And it makes the attention feel almost flitting, you know, like it's, you're going from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. Almost feel, it's hummingbird-like in the way that it flits from one little thing to the next. You know, to look at the stars and have none look at you, that was fascinating too, to be looking up at the sky and not meet the eyes of a star. Like, how would you know if a star was looking at you? So I found that very fascinating, you know, to be clinging to this star. Have hours went by, both of us alive. I find this very fascinating. I want to know what's happening so bad in that first stanza, to then be clinging to a star that flew to you. I really find this very interesting. My mind just keeps reading it, which makes it really good because I just keep reading it and imagining all the different scenarios that it could be to have a star in your hand. Wonderful word choices, wonderful imagery. And it just feels very explosive. I enjoyed the piece, the wonderful brevity. Your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, I like how you mentioned that having so many commas in there gives it like a kind of flitting, bouncing feeling. Like, you know, as you were saying that, I got the image of my mind of a baby bird that's just learning how to fly and it's not quite ready yet. So it just keeps kind of bouncing up and down on the branch of the tree, you know, preparing itself to fly. I really like how there's a very dreamy quality to the title itself, Star in My Hand. You just feel the almost the idea of leading up to a dream. And even the beginning where I walked in the air feels like a dream. And then all of a sudden, it just hits you. I heard a loud scream, the bang, bright burst, shook the horizon. I stood upright first. You know, it feels like almost like in these lines is the idea of a warning given and heeded. I look at the stars, none looked at me, flew, so I held this starlight brimming colorfully. You know, it's interesting. It almost makes me think of that saying. It kind of makes me think of that saying about how one bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And it's like, if you have this light, if you have this good thing in your hand, why would you let this one star go for all the other stars? You know, I feel like there could almost be a metaphor there. So beautifully written brevity and intriguing, very well done.
I love that comment, Pam. The idea of why look up at all the stars that don't see you when you have a star in your hand. I think that's an excellent point, and it makes me look at this differently, you know, especially where it says, I held it in my hands, gentle, seen, too. You know, like the star sees me, like there's two of us. You know, versus all the stars in the sky that don't see me anyway. I think that's an excellent observation, and I think there's a strong likelihood that that's accurate. Great, great observation, Pam. Thank you. Where are we off to now?
Well, I did notice you had one SoundCloud, so I fear we better get to that one. Turtle Tears by Just Old Me, and I'll go ahead and push play. So here we go.
Why must my tears decide to stay inside like frightened turtles safe within their shell? Emotions, threatening a great divide, resolve to wall of space and say farewell to grief. Oh, grief, those pesky little flies who land repeatedly beneath my nose. Instead of letting tears legitimize, I shrink, I numb my heart by writing prose. The words are filling up an empty page but dry, like turtle eyes when writer's block makes worthless claims. So I will disengage, not knowing how to make these ducks unlock. How long will turtles seek a place of peace? Perhaps until my grieving drought will cease.
Excellent, excellent poem. And thank you, Jeff Oldney, for the SoundCloud. It's lovely to hear this in your voice and to hear how it was intended to be written. I really enjoyed this write as well. I found it very relatable. I don't cry much. It's probably related to childhood trauma, but I just don't. Like, horrible and sad things will happen, and I just won't cry about it, even when I want to, like even when I wish I could cry, and I just don't. And I feel like this is kind of getting at that same emotion, you know, asking why must my tears decide to stay inside? Like, why can't I cry? Like, why can't I even bring myself to express these feelings that I feel so deeply but just aren't readily apparent on my face, you know? I shrink. I numb my heart by writing prose. You know, instead of poetry, which evokes emotion, writing prose. And I can relate to that, too. You know, the idea of just sitting there and writing endlessly about scenery or a particular scene. You know, it's almost like a version of escapism in a way, to not feel the things that you're feeling and to step away from them a moment. I can really relate to that. The words are filling up an empty page. You know, the full page is empty. It's really going on. You know, it would feel hollow. You know, if you're grieving something, if you're really upset about something, reading an entire page that doesn't express any of those feelings can almost feel otherworldly. You know, very separate, very dissociated. So I can relate to that as well. I love the idea of grief being pesky little flies, you know, like, oh, go away, you know, just buzz off, you know, I don't want to feel sad right now. You know, no one wants to feel negative emotions most of the time, but you should, you know, I tell myself all the time that, like, there are no bad feelings, there are negative feelings, but there are no bad feelings. You know, sadness is a feeling. It's not bad. I should be able to feel sad. There's nothing wrong with that. It's human. You know, but I can relate to thinking of grief and sadness as an annoyance more than something you really want to feel, especially when you can't do anything about it. You know, grief is about the loss of something and the inability to fix it, the inability to do anything. You know, that powerlessness, really struggling. You know, how long will turtles seek a place of peace? You know, when will the turtle poke his little head out and cry? You know, just waiting to cry, waiting to feel the things that you feel, or at least express them physically. I related to this very well, because that is a place I know too well. So I really like this. Great sonnet. Yeah, your thoughts.
Yeah, this is very relatable. It's beautifully written. I love the raw honesty of it. I too am one of those people, you know, who I don't always show a lot of emotion, or the type of emotion that I should, at least I think, you know. And as you said, there's no right or wrong when it comes to emotions, you know. But, you know, it's difficult, because there are times, you know, when you want to cry, like you feel you should be crying and yet you don't. And I too really liked how he said, to grief, oh grief, those pesky little flies. I, I also thought just adding in the extra "to grief, oh grief" kind of really added a classic poem feel to it, the very dramatic flair that I particularly liked. I also really liked the words are filling up an empty page, but dry like turtle eyes when writer's block makes worthless claims, so I will disengage. I thought disengage, besides offering up the rhyme that he obviously wanted, was a perfect word choice for the way that, you know, when we're almost feeling overwhelmed by what's inside us, we pull ourselves away, you know. So just a wonderful write and very well done.
Agreed. I'm glad you pointed out that to grief, oh grief, because I think if I were to have read the poem without the sound cloud, it would have sounded more Shakespearean, you know, more like a lament. You know, to grief, oh grief, those pesky little flies. But to hear it in his voice, which is, again, sound clouds are wonderful, he makes it almost comedic. You know, instead of being like grief, oh grief, it's grief, oh grief. You know, like good grief. Like, it adds a comedy to the reading of it that I really enjoyed. I'm glad you pointed out this line because I remember thinking that when I heard the sound cloud, I'm like, wow, that's not how I would have read that, but I like it. It felt almost Charlie Brownish, the way he read it. So a bit of rhyme to the tone.
Yeah, and that is the great thing about getting sound clouds is, you know, we get to hear, as you said, the poets, how they would want the poem read. So,
yeah.
And up next we have Beyond Awareness by Blue Leader One. Out amongst the inky blackness burns a fire too large and furious to be contained. I wish to be there, to be immolated, to be purified and sanctified, for myself to be disintegrated and scattered, blown by universal winds beyond eternity. Across the nine dimensions, there will be a little piece of me, superluminal and free. End poem.
I enjoyed this brevity. I love that it starts with just the word out on its own line. Out. We're not here. Somewhere else. Somewhere far away. That there's not even much else to describe it. Just out. I think is a wonderful way to start a poem. I feel like that's a strong opening. It's very attention-grabbing, and I think it pulls you right in. Amongst the inky blackness burns a fire. A fire too large and furious to be contained. So the view, you know, the view of what you can't imagine, out past what you can even think of, they think of a giant fire, like a huge fire past darkness, which is just really fascinating. And to want to go there and be burnt, you know, basically cremated, you know, it's just feel, I get the impression that it's almost like the idea of nirvana, you know, the oneness, to become nothing and everything all at once. It's kind of the feel I get from this description, you know, self to be disintegrated and scattered, blown by universal winds beyond eternity. It's just to just cease to exist and have peace with that, I think is beautiful. And I think it's described very well. Across the nine dimensions, I love that there's not, you know, it's not four, it's not 12, it's nine. I think it's a really interesting number to choose for that. You know, a little piece of me, superluminal and free. You know, again, existing but not existing. It makes me think of my dad because he passed away when I was little, but he wanted to be cremated when he died, and he wanted to be buried under a lilac tree. And his reasoning for that was ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Like, everything has been a part of everything forever. And he doesn't want to be, like, entombed. He wanted to be put back into the earth to become part of another life cycle, part of another existence. And I always thought that as I got older and I thought more about what that meant, you know, I thought more about Carl Sagan, you know, and how we're all we're all bits of stardust, and how it works even on a grander scale. You know, everything that is has been something else, and I think that's just a wonderful concept. And I feel like it's mirrored here in this piece. You know, just that the freedom of not existing yet being a part of everything because you were. So, wonderful, right? I really thought it was beautifully philosophical for such a short piece and for being a new right. Well done. Your thoughts, Kim?
Yeah, wonderful comment there. I too really liked that he started the poem with brevity with the word out, because the single word out on its own feels like a command. Like you could just see someone pointing to a door and saying out. What I find intriguing also is the question in the middle, because it leaves you to ponder, was this the second person that came in, or was there the whole time, but you don't really know their presence is there until they ask the question to be emulated? Or is this the narrative of the poem, the idea of someone conversing with themselves, someone saying this is, to themselves, this is what I want, and then asking themselves, but why do I want it? Because sometimes we want something, but we don't think about the why. You know, like, what is my truth? And I did like how the, like you mentioned, the idea that to become a part of a bigger something, you know, across the nine dimensions, there will be a little piece of me. And to think that in such a vast universe, a small piece of you will continue to exist. It's beautifully written and very well done.
Yeah, agreed. I do think it's just very beautifully written for how short it is. In my mind, the to be immolated question was internal. Like, I definitely, for me, got the impression that this was self-referential, you know, like an exploring of one's own philosophy on death, or what it would be like to go out and dissolve. So I thought it was very well done.
Okay, cool, yeah. I like that, and I can definitely see that. And our last poem for the night, and all the rest will be carryovers for your show next week, the few left, is On New Horizons by Ron Wiseman. And Babbler, will you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. This is On New Horizons by Ron Wiseman. On new horizons and in ocean's solitude, I'd be happy to sip with my darling. Even at dawn on these horizons, I'd clasp you to me upon these hills. You see, when young, I vowed to have a small cottage on a hill. I vowed this long, long before death would beckon to be far, far away from that buzzing hive, the city, and on the hill a garden make, a seat for the view, a few friends, good books, computer. But I was wise and then delighted to claim a wondrously fair woman, to marry and cherish, one who stood first upon my fresh horizon. She is all the world to my heart, one from whom I'll not dare depart, for in her at dawn, noon, or at dusk, lie my riches, nature's treasury. End poem. I enjoyed this. You know, to me, it was about changing dreams, you know, how horizons change. You know, the direction that you go changes, and that's not bad. You know, it's just different, and sometimes it's better. You know, to think when I was young, I was going to have this little cottage on a hill, and it was going to be out in the middle of nowhere, and I was going to have a garden, and I'd have my friends over, and that was the fantasy. But then I met someone, and my horizons changed. You know, what I wanted changed, and now I don't care anything about that small cottage on the hill, as beautiful as it is and how it's still wonderfully described. The only thing I care about now is is this woman that I love, and how to spend every day with her, you know, to sit with my darling at dawn on these horizons, you know, so anywhere, just as long as she's there, never mind the house on the hills. I thought it was beautifully done, and it's a wonderful love poem, you know, about how plans change, really, you know, and not necessarily for the worse, sometimes for the better, you know, sometimes change is good. A lot of times change is good, actually. I thought it was beautiful and romantic, and I enjoyed it. So thank you, Ron Wiseman. Your thoughts, Pam?
Yeah, this is a beautiful write, and it does have a romantic feel to it. And, you know, I have to agree with you. I like how it's not presented as good or bad as far as if your plans change. You know, it's the idea that they do, that your horizon gets moved. There's things that become more or less important to you as you grow older. And here you can see that, you know, obviously what he thought was important was having the perfect home and the perfect spot and the, you know, the computer, the books, the friends, but then to find that someone that fulfilled your heart and, you know, brought to you a true love became the biggest treasure of all, you know, so just a wonderful write and just beautifully written and very well done. And great show tonight, Babbler. Oh, no, shoot. Well, Babbler dropped with only 1 minute and 55 seconds, so hopefully she'll call back. But in the meantime, we'll see if she calls back. And great show, Babbler. Thank you to Jean for everything you do in the background. Thank you to, everybody. There we go. Now she can close up her show. All right. I wasn't sure if you'd make it back, so I was kind of wrapping things up, you know, not in a big hurry. Wasn't going to hang up on you, but and great show tonight, Babbler.
And that's it. Okay, bye. Great poetry tonight. Thank you so much, Pam, for filling in and joining. Wonderful writes. We have some carryovers for next week. So if you didn't hear your piece this week, it'll probably be next week. We'll show it. Thanks again, everyone, for all of the lovely writes. Ephesiana should be back with us next week. Thanks again, everybody. And, of course, thanks to Phil also for making the show possible. And I'll see you all next week. Have a good one. Good night, everybody.
Good night.